This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The army has staged military exercises to mark the anniversary of the Saudi-led coalition's war on the country. Israeli forces fatally shoot another Palestinian in the occupied West Bank. And fresh protests howled across France after President Macron announces a firm stance on the government's pension reforms plan. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining us. My name is Kisumisha Ahmadi and these are our top stories this hour. Yemen's armed forces have staged drills marking 8 years of Saudi-led coalition war on the country. The military maneuver stimulated an attack on a group of targets in a variety of terrains, including mountainous, desert-like, and forested areas. Yemen's military and infantry units, drone units, and missile units took part in the drills. The defense ministry has warned Yemen's response to a new attack would be, quote, surprising. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 with armed and logistics supports from the Western partners. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed ever since. A UN-brokered ceasefire that took effect in April 2022 brought a sharp reduction in hostilities. Clashes have once again erupted in the occupied territories between Israeli regime forces and protesters demonstrating against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. The protesters blocked the roads in what they call a day of shutdown. Several protesters were arrested. The Knesset just approved a law that shields Netanyahu, who faces corruption charges, from being removed from office. The law is part of judicial overhaul bills that have triggered weeks of discontent. If approved by the Knesset, the law would grant the ruling coalition more powers in appointing judges. Critics argue that legal changes will foster corruption and bring about diplomatic isolation. Palestinians held in Israeli jails have ended their hunger strike after Israeli regime gave in to their demands. This has been hailed as a massive victory by resistance groups. The Hamas movement says the victory has unleashed a new chapter of resistance against the Israeli regime. The Islamic Jihad also vowed to stand by Palestinian prisoners and fight for their rights. At least 2,000 Palestinian inmates took part in the hunger strike. The action began on March 22nd in protest at a push by Israeli Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir to worsen the already dire incarceration conditions. The Israeli regime has now agreed to stop the oppressive measures. Welcome to another edition of the News Review. In this edition, rising Israeli violence against Palestinians has claimed yet another victim. The regime forces have fatally shot a Palestinian man in the occupied West Bank. 25-year-old Amir Imad Abu Khadija was shot multiple times in the head and the lower limbs. The killing took place during an Israeli raid on the northwestern city of Tulkarm. Abu Khadija was a leader of the Tulkarm branch of Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigade in the armed wing of the Fatah resistance movement. The Tulkarm Brigade vowed to avenge his killing and to continue the resistance. So far this year, the Israeli regime has killed some 90 Palestinians in the West Bank, and that is the deadliest start of the year for Palestinians in more than two decades. To discuss that further, we're joined by Charlotte Cates, International Coordinator, after Samidun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver. Also, we have with us Mohsen Naqvi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. Let's begin with Charlotte. 90 people have been killed since the beginning of 2023. This is one of the worst years that Palestinians have begun with escalated Israeli aggression. What does this signify?
Well, it signifies several things. One is that the occupation forces are becoming increasingly desperate and bloodthirsty in their effort to suppress the Palestinian people and their resistance, which they've been unable to do so for over 75 years. We see the installation of this openly fascist government containing these figures like Smotrich, Ben-Gvir, and Netanyahu, which of course is nothing new to the Zionist project, but at the same time, this they're attempting to kill the rising Palestinian resistance through all means, through massacres, through attacks, through mass imprisonment, but they've failed to succeed in doing so. And one of the things that unfortunately this also reflects, for Palestinians is there are no limits being placed on the Zionist regime by its supporters and its funders in the United States, the European Union, and the other Western countries that are responsible for the outrageous and illegal behavior of the Zionist occupier. At the same time, the Palestinian resistance has continued to grow despite these killings, despite these massacres, and is continuing to make it clear that the Palestinian people will never be erased from nor evacuated from their land.
So, Mr. Naqvi, in your opinion, less than 3 months, and we already have 90 people that have been killed by the Israeli regime forces. Also, let's not forget that just a couple of days ago, an Israeli minister stood next to a map that included Jordan in the occupied territories, clearly stating that Palestinians do not exist. What does this mean?
Well, this is an attempt by the fascist Israeli regime, by this new, the new Knesset, to really try and expand their territories. I think that the obnoxious statement of including Jerusalem within their own territories was primarily a failed symbolic representation of the Israeli regime's true intent. Meaning, if countries like Jordan in the past have ever felt the need of having peace accords with the Israeli regime, or even have considered having friendly ties with the Israeli regime, they need to understand that the Israeli establishment is not there to be your friend. They are and will always be your foe. And this new government is really And we all expected that a government in which Netanyahu holds hands and creates these ties with the fascist groups led by people like Ben-Gvir, it was expected that this would happen. I mean, from storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque as soon as they came to power to now this, to now having these protests in Israel where the majority, the judicial system of Israel has been incapacitated from determining whether a certain prime minister is incapable of performing their duties or not. Meaning, where is that trichotomy of power? So the atrocities of the Israeli regime, the unfairness of the Israeli regime and the Western Empire have also become quite apparent to those who live in Zionist occupied Palestine. And that's why we see all of these protests that are going on. So they may try and exert force, but they need to first focus on their own land right now, because the kind of pushback that we see from the citizens of occupied Palestine, we haven't ever seen that before. So Israel has a lot to worry about right now. We have never seen Israel as weak as it is right now in terms of its domestic politics, to be more specific.
Exactly. And let's add to that the fact that a roadside bomb was placed right across the border, and actually people were able to infiltrate inside that region in order to place a roadside bomb. Charlotte, considering all the facts that our guest from Houston, Mr. Naqvi, pointed out to What do you think Israel should do? It's also dealing with a lot of protests inside the country right now.
Well, I mean, the Zionist project is fundamentally illegitimate. It's an illegitimate settler colonial project implanted on Palestinian land, and it needs to be dismantled in order to liberate Palestine from the river to the sea, in order to build a real democratic society in the hands of the Palestinian people with autonomy over the entirety of Palestinian land. But at the same time, it's very clear that what we're seeing is an internal crisis in the Zionist project, where the contradictions of the Zionist project, the internal contradictions between various political forces, and of course the contradictions that emerge from being a settler colonial project implanted into the heart of the Arab region, are coming to the forefront. And these contradictions are also being reflected in these ongoing attacks against Palestinians, because there's an attempt by the Zionist regime to externalize its internal conflict and force and create war and attacks and violence against the Palestinian people in order to refocus the Zionist population from internal issues to aggression against the Palestinian people, which has always been the kind of reason for existence of the project in the region. And so that's one reason why we're seeing this level of violence and these level of attacks is partially a reflection of displacing this ongoing internal Zionist conflict that simply reflects the illegitimacy and incongruence of this state project.
So, Mr. Nafi, to wrap up our discussion, what responsibility is bestowed on the international community at this point?
Well, Israel doesn't abide by the International Court of Justice. We all know that they don't even consider even a recommendation by the ICC as something that they may even take as a persuasive precedent, unfortunately. So that goes on to show how arrogant the Zionist regime is. As far as the international community is concerned, we're in the month of Ramadan right now, and in the month of Ramadan, in the last week of Ramadan, Muslims all over the world and freedom-loving people all over the world, on the last week of Ramadan, they come out to protest against the Israeli regime. So the citizens of the world, it is the responsibility of all citizens of the world to come out and protest against these atrocities that the Israeli regime is not just committing against Palestinians, but also against those Jews who live in Israel. So we need to speak up, we need to stand up as a one global community and protest against Israel. Imam Khomeini declared mandatory, obligatory upon all freedom-loving people, especially the Shias, to stand up against Israel, to stand up against the Zionist regime on the last month of Ramadan. And then we see places like Yemen, we see places like Syria, places like Nigeria, who within themselves have been so brutally massacred by the Western Empire, to also come out and speak up against Zionist Israel, because we genuinely think that all the atrocities of the world, all the oppression that we see in the world today, their roots are with the Zionist regime. Their roots are in Israel. That's why Palestine is such a central topic for all freedom-loving activists and people. And so I would urge all activists to start working towards organizing a protest, a rally in their local towns. And if they can't organize one, make sure they at least join one if it's already happening in their local cities.
Thank you very much, Mohsen Nafi, human rights activist from Houston, Texas, and also Charlotte Cates, international coordinator of the Samidun Palestinian Prisoners Solidarity Network from Vancouver. Thank you very much to both of you for sharing your thoughts and views with us on this edition of the News Review. Moving on to France, people are swarming the streets amid ongoing protests against the government's unpopular pension reforms plan. Labor unions had called on the crowds to rally against what they call President Emmanuel Macron's scorn and lies. Thursday also marks the ninth day of nationwide strikes. Train services were disrupted and some schools were shut, while garbage piled up on the streets as the country has been the scene of protests and strikes since Meko announced his proposal in January. Public anger escalated last week when the government adopted the pension reform bill without parliament vote. Macron has doubled down on his plan to lift the retirement age by 2 years, saying that it will come into force by year-end. The latest wave of protests represents the most serious challenge to the president's authority since the Yellow Vest movement, which took place 4 years ago. Meanwhile, French opposition lawmakers have strongly criticized Macron's policies. Here's what some of them had to say.
He says that he respects the protesters, but he insults them, and he insults all French in general, all those who, in virtue of the respect of the Constitution, are protesting, including those who are protesting peacefully or those who are respecting the Constitution and are going on a strike. We see that in reality he has in him an anger that he cannot get under control toward those who disagree with him.
He's an absolute pyromaniac. He's setting this country on fire. He pushes people towards entrenchment. He creates anger. He's the one who fuels the fire today, then tomorrow. He'll say that it's dangerous and that he's the order in the face of chaos. But he's the one creating the chaos. That's the problem. He has become an instrument of chaos. And that's the whole problem with Emmanuel Macron.
You know, the only thing that could have calmed all of this was to hold a vote on pension reform in the National Assembly. Now, daring to call it a victory after he bypassed the vote of the people's representatives, that seems a bit provocative or even inappropriate to me.
Iran's foreign minister has stressed the Islamic Republic's readiness to develop and strengthen relations with Saudi Arabia. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was speaking in a phone call with his Saudi counterpart, Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud. He also welcomed the normalization of ties between Tehran and Riyadh. The top diplomats agreed to hold a meeting soon to pave the way for the reopening of the two countries' embassies and consulates general. Tehran and Riyadh signed a Chinese brokered deal earlier this month to normalize relations 7 years after they were severed. The two countries agreed to recommence the diplomatic ties, open embassies in their respective capitals within 2 months. And journalist Sasha Krishnamurthy has told us that the Chinese brokered deal between Iran and Saudi Arabia could have repercussions for the U.S. and Israel in the region.
What I think is that China kind of finally is ready to assert its role as the leader in Asia. And of course, Iran is a very good ally, and Saudi Arabia is probably the strongest ally the U.S. has ever had. And if they are able to distance Saudi Arabia from the U.S., of course, it is better for China in the long run, because the U.S. has explained how it wants to be the aggressor against China and limit China's growth. And so I think this is just the next stage. And I personally see that this is a big step, because the Saudi-Iranian diplomatic relations was in 2016, when Sheikh Nimr got executed, they cut off diplomatic relations. So this is a very big first step. And of course, the biggest player in the Middle East who's going to feel the negative repercussions from this is Israel, who already explained that they're not very happy with this deal.
That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Welcoming God's Month. In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. The great month of Sha'ban is reaching its end, and the blessed month of Ramadan is approaching. The arrival of the spring of nature is coinciding with the arrival of the spring of the Noble Quran. God's month, Ramadan. The sweet scent of chrysanthemums and daffodils has mixed with the enlivening fragrance of the blessed Ramadan, the month of fasting. Once again, we are going to fast, to pray and supplicate before God, seeking His mercy and forgiveness. But what is fasting and who is the true fasting person? This year, as houses have been cleansed for Nowruz, youths and teenagers have cleaned mosques to welcome the blessed month of Ramadan. God says in verse 125 of chapter Baqarah of the Noble Quran, "We charged Abraham and Ishmael with the upkeep of Kaaba, saying, 'Purify my house for those who guard around it, those who make it a retreat, and those who bow and prostrate.'" The blessed month of Ramadan is the best time for a new beginning. The Messenger of Mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says in his sermon before the arrival of Ramadan, "O people, God's month has turned toward you with blessing, mercy, and forgiveness. It is the month which is the best of months with God. Its days are better than all days, and its nights are better than all nights. Its hours are better than all hours. It is the month in which you have been invited to God's banquet. Your breaths are considered as glorification of God, and your sleep as worship. Your deed is accepted by God, and your prayer is answered in this month. Every banquet has its special codes and manners, and Ramadan is no exception in this regard. However, in ordinary banquets and parties, the guest and the host are humans, while in the blessed month of Ramadan, the God is the host, and the servants are his guests. Therefore, we should observe carefully the manners of this banquet. The Prophet of Islam and his Ahlul Bayt's infallible progeny used to welcome the blessed month of Ramadan by fasting a few days before the arrival of the month. Great scholar of several centuries ago, Sayyid ibn Tawus, says in one of his books, "When the blessed month of Ramadan arrived, the Prophet's face color would change, and he would pray and supplicate very much." Another Muslim scholar of the 7th century AH, Abu Zakaria Yahya ibn Sharaf, writes, "Know that it is recommended for a person who has been granted a new bounty or a calamity has been removed from him to prostrate as thanksgiving before Almighty God and praise God as he deserves. The success to worship is among the greatest bounties of God on the servant. Therefore, once a Muslim reaches the month of Ramadan in full health, this is a great bounty per se, which deserves to thank God." Thank you. The Prophet's fourth infallible successor, Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, said at the coming of Ramadan, "Praise belongs to Allah who bestowed his religion upon us and selected us for his nation and admitted us in his ways of goodness. Set among these ways his month, the month of Ramadan, the month of fasting, and the month of Islam, and the month of purity, and the month of expurgation, and the month of maintaining prayer. Among other manners of entering God's banquet is to attain heart purity and remembrance of God. This will cause liveliness inwardly. One may ask, how can achieve liveliness after several hours of abstaining from eating and drinking? If the servant knows that all his deeds are done before God, and he's aware of whatever will occur to his servant, this will make the servant lively. He knows that the all-knowing and all-powerful God sees his deeds and will not leave his deeds without reward. The promise of reward will cause vividness and hope. Fasting causes vividness like physical exercise, which causes health and vividness, although it is tiring. The great source of emulation and exegete of the Noble Quran, Ayatollah Abdullah Jawadi Amoli, says, Abu Ali Sina mentions an example, saying that human being has a spirit and a body. Neither the body is the basis nor is it the partner to the spirit, because the body is administered by the spirit. This body wants food, but in the state of joy and sorrow, we have seen that this body doesn't want anything. If a person is going to have a feast for his child, he moves from morning till midnight welcoming the guests. He has not eaten anything since morning till midnight, and at midnight, when he's given dinner, he says, I don't have appetite, because he's so happy. In joy and happiness, the spirit doesn't heed the body. It is heeding its lofty goal. As it does not heed the body, it doesn't want food while it is healthy too. But it says, I have no appetite. God forbid, if a person has lost a dear one, he's engaged from morning till evening in funeral, burial, and forcing the dead. When he finishes his work at midnight, he has no appetite for food. Why? Because his spirit is somewhere else. The body is not the basis. Now, let us end this episode with a supplication by Imam Sajjad, peace upon him, at the threshold of the blessed month of Ramadan. Praise belongs to Allah, who venerated us with you, O the blessed Ramadan. O Allah, give us the power to fast and keep night vigil and make our steps firm and make us triumph over the faithless. O Allah, you are one, so there is no child for you, and you are self-sufficient, so there is no similar for you, and you are mighty, while nothing makes you mighty. You are self-sufficient, and I am the poor, and you are the Lord, and I am the servant, and you are the forgiver, and I am the sinner. And you are the merciful, and I am the transgressor. And you are the creator, and I am the created. And you are the living, and I am the dead. I ask you with your mercy to forgive me. Have mercy upon me and pardon me. Indeed, you have power over all things.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Hidden Files.
And a mule. That's right, 40 acres and a mule. After 246 years of slavery, that is what African Americans who had been enslaved were promised by the U.S. government. Well, that was back in 1865, and although that was no real compensation for 2.5 centuries of slavery, even that promise was not kept towards Black Americans. It became symbolic of all the other promises, laws, programs that were supposed to bring about more economic parity with whites for Black Americans, but never took place. Hello, and welcome to Hidden Files. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Today, we're going to take you on a journey that started centuries ago on the African continent and yet still has proportional consequences on millions of African Americans today. Estimates vary from $6 trillion to $60 trillion, the value of those 40 acres and a mule today. Well, the wealth never paid to the former slaves nor their descendants. The generational wealth that was never passed down, that opportunity, like so many others, that was never provided to blacks, while endless opportunities, grants, raises, stipends, etc., were given to white Americans. The results show a staggering difference between black and white wealth, even in America today.
In 2019, the median white household was worth $188,200. The median black household held $24,100 in wealth. White households had 7.8 times more wealth than blacks. In 2020, whites made up 60% of the U.S. population, but held 84% of the total household wealth. Black households, who constituted 13.4% of the U.S. population, held 4% of the total household wealth. White households inherit over 5.3 times more than black households. And white households are 2.8 times more likely than black households to inherit any wealth.
Well, we're going to dig into this issue further with our first guest, Cam Howard.
Cam Howard is a reparations expert who has been fighting for decades to get reparations for black Americans. He has addressed the United Nations and has traveled the world presenting the case for reparations for African Americans. He is an administrator for NCOBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America.
Thanks so much for being with us. Do you think that black Americans should get reparations, and if so, why?
So I certainly believe that blacks in this country should get reparations. And it's primarily because of, you know, two reasons. One, there's never been justice and fairness in any large measure for African Americans, people of African descent in this country. As you know, we came here as stolen, kidnapped people from the continent of Africa to slave in the cotton fields and tobacco fields and rice fields in America, and then later in some of the factories during the industrial age. The tremendous amount of crimes were committed against us during the period of enslavement. But then after the period of enslavement, we had a brief period called Reconstruction in this country where there was some semblance of fairness and justice. Then that was followed by another 80 plus years of terroristic apartheid by white supremacist organizations in this country that removed, again, all notions of fairness and justice in the areas of education, in areas of economics, in the area of labor, employment, et cetera. There was criminal punishment, criminal justice. There's been no fairness. There was no fairness. It was an apartheid system backed by the terror of the state. And then after the Jim Crow period, apartheid period in this country in 1965 and the 60s, as a result of the civil rights movement, we had a small window of fairness and justice with the Civil Rights Act, the Fair Housing Act, and the Voting Rights Act that was passed. And then in the 70s, we had a semblance of fairness with affirmative action. But all those things have been stripped down, taken away the teeth of what should have been given to us in the area of fairness and justice. They've been watered down. So when you look at the police violence in our communities, it's still a continuation of the non-fair and non-just treatment that we receive in this country. So, you know, only a brief, very brief periods in this country of African Americans ever received the type of fair and just treatment that immigrants and people who are, you know, other Americans or people who just come to America, they receive just by being on within these boundaries. But African Americans as a whole, we have not shared any type of governmental fairness and justice for the long haul. Secondly, reparations are due because of the tremendous injury that we still suffer from today as a result of these hundreds of years, centuries of mistreatment in this country. When you look at every area of people of activity in this country, Blacks on the bottom of every good list, and on the top of every bad list, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's criminal punishment, whether it's wealth, whether it's, you know, health, maternal mortality, infant mortality, all these things, you see a stark difference between Black lived experience and white lived experience in this country.
Well, what type of reparations are you proposing?
We look at reparations in the forms of, from the international law standpoint, of gross crimes committed by a state against the civilian population, where that tends to lay out what is known as full reparation. And there's five basic components. First component is cessation and guarantees of non-repetition. First, you must stop the bad acts. You must eliminate the public policy that disproportionately negatively affect people of African descent in this country. That's first and foremost. The criminal justice laws, the housing laws, the economic laws that exist, the disproportionate resource allocation toward education and other aspects of our community. First, you must cease those policies and then put in place structures that ensure that those policies don't show up again. Like when enslavement ended, enslavement resurfaced for another 45 years in the form of convict leasing, in the form of sharecropping, in the form of debt peonage, where, you know, that we still existed in enslavement, but it was not called enslavement. So we need to stop these bad policies that exist today and make sure that we put in structures that don't resurface. The second component of full reparations is restitution. How do you return the people back to where they would have been had these crimes not committed? So we're talking centuries of crime. So there's going to be multiple generations of repair that's necessary in the areas of education, in the areas of economic development and wealth building and employment and these type of areas and land acquisition and housing. All these areas have to be addressed and redressed with targeted resources. The third component is compensation. When restitution doesn't alleviate a situation, the compensation is an obligatory form of reparations under international norms. And we certainly know that in order for us to have some type of parity and wealth in this country, there's going to have to be some type of direct compensation We don't know what that be and how much it would be, but certainly we are fighting for that because it is, again, obligatory on international law to redress the situation in its entirety. The fourth component of full reparations is satisfaction. How do you return the dignity back to a people whose dignity was eroded as a result of the crimes you committed against them? Sometimes an apology will do that. Other times, you know, museums, markers, removing a statuary, creating monuments, new monuments, curriculum overhaul, truth and reconciliation commissions, those type of things lend to dignity, return, or satisfaction. And then the fifth component is rehabilitation for the mind, heart, and spirit damage to the people as a result of their crimes. Black people in America have the worst health profile among any people. Our health profile is similar to those in quote-unquote third world countries in certain areas. Highest rates of cancer, highest rate of heart attack, highest rates of infant mortality, maternal mortality, as I stated, highest rates of breast cancers among women, the highest rates of testicular cancer or prostate cancer among men. I mean, the health profile is terrible. And we know now through transgenerational epigenetic inheritance that that health profile is a result of the historical trauma we've experienced as a people in this country.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Cam Howard. Going to take a look at a few instances that have taken a place over the years and why African Americans are demanding reparations. You know, slavery launched modern capitalism and actually turned the United States into the wealthiest country in the world. Looking at this cotton production, I mean, by the 1830s, 77% of U.S. cotton was used for the British textile industry. And look at that, 2.25 billion pounds of cotton in 1859. And you know, the cotton actually built New York City as the commercial and financial center. And if you look at the whole worth after the outbreak of the Civil War and the values of slaves, $3 billion, 48% of total wealth in the South in 1860. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction, as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, when the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, you know, the first thing should be, we should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and you know, the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So, yeah, we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash, because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable, make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few, quote unquote, African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination and you don't have a place of your own, and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, you know, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, you know, as treated like domesticated animals. You know, so they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal. You know, even on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects. You know, even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans. And we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So, you know, so yeah, so these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse You know what I'm saying? Like, we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, you know, like I said, domesticated animals. Like, we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved, we were tortured, and to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Changa, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote-unquote third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, you know, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time. And we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team right here next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa. And FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.